This reading is from Richard Rose's Albigen Papers, the seventh paper, Discernment. Milk from Thorns. It may be said that the Absolute is a state or essence from which all untruths have been subtracted, leaving behind a region of pure fact. Such a statement as pure fact would of a necessity mean non-relative fact, a state undefinable because all facts, if described or stated immediately, are qualified with colors not intrinsic to the fact state itself. I have tried to describe the effects of this coloration upon the mind of man so that we can expect to suffer its removal. The most treacherous coloring agent for all fact-finding is the self with its emotions and voices. By the self is here meant not the final absolute self, but the apparent self, the self which we accept as us. As we run the gamut of many religions, cults, or teachers, we discover only later that they were acceptable in the first place because they flattered ourselves. Rarely are they really accepted because of their logical symmetry, and rarely do we try to protect them with logical implementation or common sense, but choose to confound our critics with such protests as divine visitation or intuitional guidance. If our intuition is not perfected, this maneuver will only serve to bury us deeper. We are only setting up a smoke screen to prevent further questioning. This paper is not designed to muckrake religions that are sincere, nor to bring despair to people who are sincere, but whose capacity will not allow them to probe into clearer waters. I doubt if anyone will experience too great a feeling of despair because those who cling too tightly to blind belief have a perception apparatus that blinks shut at the mere approach of the next step. They have an automatic control valve. I must admit that I have depicted man as being little more than a helpless fish out of water. Gurdjieff depicts man as being asleep, functioning in graded stages of sleepwalking. Vanderloo sees man as being the figure in the cave, chained to his ignorance and beguiled by shadows. If all of this is true, we are at a terrible disadvantage, to say the least, so much so that most men sense this from the beginning and decide not to try to find reality. Like a drowning man who is beginning to relax and find peace in giving up the struggle, we weigh the effort that is needed to keep ourselves awake long enough to solve the problem. A true seeker is a very unique person. Outwardly, he will not appear to be different from anyone else. His uniqueness comes from the particular game that he plays. He allows himself to become addicted or to become a vector once the idea of being a vector makes sense to him. He is like an eccentric deep-sea diver who has experienced the rapture of the deep. He needs no other motive to live except to live to continue the pursuit that seems to hold the most promise. The enlightened man has nothing to live for by most people's standards, and yet he continues to live. Everyone else always seems to have something to live for, but they are always ultimately disappointed. The seeker gradually grows indifferent to the objects of his appetites and continues to move, even though those objects are the only motivation for other people. And with this thought, we come to the business of taking advantage from a negative situation or taking milk from thorns. It has been said previously that the man who begins a search changes as he goes down or up the path. The man who arrives is not the same man who started out. Many a person has entered a religious life in order to get rich or to set up a foundation to avoid taxes. Others have gone into occultism with the idea of getting power. Some have entered monasteries because they had homosexual inclinations. Yet many who so became so fascinated by the study of the truth and lived to observe the untruthfulness of their initial motives and also lived to make progress on the path. These errors are not to be laid at the feet of mankind, but largely at the feet of nature. I have proposed that nature is both waxing and waning, and that in order to prevent all of the visible universe from collapsing into a void of inertness, there are certain implants or revitalizing factors that charge the ever-collapsing fountain of protoplasm and planets alike. These implants may be a dynamic catalyst that is not only present in the genes of the chromosomes, but in every atom nucleus as well. As I noted, that they stir us in the form of curiosity and desire. This power source is like controlled atomic energy. It is as relentless as death. Why not tap it? Some of us do. Some of us allow our curiosity to study curiosity. We go along for the ride. Gurdjieff studied the behavior patterns by doing the opposite of expected behavior, so that he could observe the results and possibly be freed by those observations. It is evident that the purpose of curiosity is to move the being or person from his immediate environment in search of food and a sexual mate. The curiosity urge thus promotes a healthy species, because without it, the mating would occur within a sibling circle with consequent degeneration of the species. When man began to consciously focus his curiosity upon something besides food and sex, the era of science began, and of course it looked as though man was on his way to becoming a free agent, or an agent in charge of his environment at least. But nature managed to move back in at almost every effort which he made to liberate himself. At this point, we do not need to enumerate the means by which nature brought this about. We can look at the list of obstacles in the fifth paper. Only the relentless study of curiosity itself will give us its meaning and point to us the worth of applying that curiosity to self-definition rather than to the creation of mountains of scientific definitions relative only to the functioning of bodies. The observation of sex will show that animals build up energy to a point where they are of an age and ability for reproduction. Then they are either allowed to grow weaker because their purpose is attained, or else the process of reproduction triggers a weakening process. We have heard of the death gene, and it may be that such exists, and if it exists, it must find its cause before or beyond the individual's life experience. For centuries, mystics have looked upon sex with a seemingly unfavorable eye, and some pledged themselves to a life of celibacy. They did this because some of them thought that sex was an entrapment. But some went a step further and tried to use sex or the inhibited sexual energy to build for themselves and of themselves a new mental mansion. The inhibition of the appetites for a period of time is conducive to the development of the intuition. Sex, being the appetite with the strongest influence, must be proportionately inhibited. A variation of this idea is found in a yoga science devoted to raising the kundalini. The illumination of the chakras is supposedly effected in this manner. In the Western world, Percival came up with his book, Thinking and Destiny, the keynote of which claims that man is able to raise and transmute his seed atom and thus bring about immortality. These concepts should not be called absurd until we know the complete line of thinking. I do not believe that the concepts, were created out of whole cloth. I do believe that we certainly will attain a new perspective if the usual sex flow or expected sex flow is inhibited or rechanneled. Mystics must have found that celibacy was amenable to the search, or they would have given up after 100 years or more of the experiment. Since the sect act has a definite impact upon the mind, inasmuch as it is able to alter states of mind or to bring about deceptive states of mind, it is worthwhile to assume that the inhibition or control of the sex act will somehow inhibit or control a state of mind that is not conducive to our search. I do not presume to identify the complex mechanics of this tool or lever. In other words, the sex instinct that has been implanted may be used to promote other than its manifest purpose. We can even speculate that the intelligence that designed this scene, the creation, planned it so that some shrewd and determined beings might find their maker if they discovered and followed some labyrinth leading from illusion into the sunlight, and thus discover the truth subtly woven into the fabric of the living, dying drama. In dwelling on the topic of sublimation, we are now talking about the easily understood process of invention. The wonders of invention are brought about by using things in new combinations and in ways that to all appearances are contrary to the original design. Out of the horned paradoxical world of philosophy and out of the thorny relative world of pretensive beauty, we must surely draw some studies of worth. Only through the word Satori will we know of Satori. We may experience it, but each of us will never know but that it was an experience unique unto each oneself unless someone makes the effort to talk about it. Like the fakir who stands upon his head to gain new circulation for inverted lobes in need of blood, so the mystic must stand occasionally upon his intellectual head and look at things from different angles. Relative words are supposedly used in the form of koans to bring about a wordless state of being. Prolonged observation of sense leads to an attitude or conviction that it is nonsense. It follows especially with the koan that a prolonged observation of nonsense may bring us to a conviction of sense. We like to think that a system that brings peace of mind is one that has the answers. But we know that peace of mind is mental lassitude, and to be really awake, it may be necessary to find an irritation to galvanize the mind from its tendency toward inertia. We like to think that scholarly study will keep us awake, and we rejoice that we have developed an interest that keeps us awake as we absorb concept after concept. But after a while, we discover that study is just the rolling up of a huge ball of yarn of relative world observations that can go on forever and never bring us closer to the understanding of the mind. We come to the conclusion that the finite mind will never pierce the infinite, nor will a cast iron ball soar into the sky by itself. However, the vehicle can change. The mind can become, at least for a short time, less finite, and the balloon can be made of cloth instead of cast iron. When a sewer is plugged, it is opened sometimes by forcing water from the opposite direction. But when a human nervous system becomes fouled, we use shock treatments, a sort of clearing of the circuits by changing the current direction or the voltage. These same reversal techniques aid in the clarification of the mind in relation to reality, meaning final reality. There are two schools of thought about the advantages to be gained by harnessing those which are generally accepted as negative or energy-spending emotions. In dealing with emotions, we find society aware of the danger that results from emotions, and lately we find society trying to rechannel that energy. It is far better if the individual finds a way to identify his violent emotions and shunt their energy by observation and analysis. In the child, the mind is not self-conscious enough, so we find children being slapped when their anger reaches a certain point. One school of thought indicates that the voice or particle self that boils with anger or hate should not cause the host to be slapped, suppressed, or eliminated. Uspensky talks of strengthening of these voices rather than their elimination. By observing them, we find new faculties which can be very useful if properly directed. The other school of thought, which is party to most theologians, holds that such voices to be evil and holds that they should be purged from the system. We might say that the observation of hate should not be strengthened for us to learn to hate haters, but rather to be unshackled from the whole impulse and to hold that the impulse is utterly absurd and energy-consuming. Once this energy is loosened, we find more time and vigor to pursue that which takes so much time and effort. We come now to systems that give credence to the concept of cosmic consciousness, and we will undertake to observe them looking for a chance to learn, if possible, the mechanism by which such an experience can be brought about. One of the most lucid books written on this subject is The Conquest of Illusion by J.J. Vanderloo. Most authors claim that it is useless to try to talk about nirvana, satori, or cosmic consciousness, or to try to verbalize phases or findings relative to such. It is just as foolish not to talk about it. I personally have encountered a few pseudo-mystics or pseudo-masters who sold their wares under the impetus that showing their proof or attempting to demonstrate the end result of their teachings was impossible. They chose to quote a line that is heard in relation to Zen teachings about one who has reached satori. He who talks does not know, and he who knows does not talk. Armed with this bit of incomplete truth, they managed to get by with a lot of quackery by parrying any pertinent question with the above quotation and the sly wisdom of silence. It is true that most people who have reached any such realization are generally reluctant to talk to those who are not close enough to their rung of the ladder to understand. It is more a matter of not wishing to waste one's energy or of avoiding the giving of an impression that might cause bad reactions. After a person has left some listeners with the impression that as a speaker he is a sly huckster or a lunatic, he will be slow in speaking of his discovery before all levels of minds. I remember recently the aftermath of a meeting with a group of ladies. They remarked after I left that I sounded like a communist. This did not result from their exposure to any arcane secrets, but to the simple exhortation to look within themselves for the truth. It is good to take a note from this. I did not check out the capacity of the members beforehand. I was invited to speak by a well-meaning lady and succeeded not one iota in being of any help for them. None of them were prepared to hear anything with which they did not already agree. To get back to Vanderloo, we find that the book describes the possibility of an absolute state. This is a powerful book in that it pioneers the attempt to explain at least satori or cosmic consciousness from a viewpoint of common sense. The mystery of life is not a problem to be solved, it is a reality to be experienced. End quote. This book, however, does not tell you precisely how to reach cosmic consciousness. Because of individual personal factors, no book can furnish a complete guaranteed roadmap. The author is very good in listing other authors such as Uspensky and Plotinus who seem to know about the subject. Vanderloo is also very good in his diagrammatic explanation of the relation of restricted or relative consciousness to absolute consciousness. We come now to Uspensky and his book, The Fourth Way. This book, as well as In Search of the Miraculous, is written as a result of his association with Gurdjieff and is an effort to convey the teachings of Gurdjieff about the liberation of the mind from illusion. Gurdjieff, via Uspensky, does go a step further than Vanderloo. He comes right down to the individual and shows each of us how we can start to eliminate self-delusion from ourselves. In practical language, Uspensky gives us techniques for emancipating ourselves from the cave of shadows. And we feel that many of these techniques were used in monasteries for decades before the time of Gurdjieff, but no one ever bothered before to explain them in layman's terms. Another author, Rolf Alexander, has come up with a variation of the Uspensky system. Mr. Alexander leads the reader to believe that his system will enable the student to control the physical environment. There is a front piece in the book showing the author in the act of dissipating some clouds by concentration. That little picture ordinarily would discourage quite a few from reading the book if such readers were interested in finding the absolute, and especially if such readers have an inkling that the physical relative world is not the object of conquest. No true possessor of cosmic consciousness would ever try to change anything but his own erratic view of the world picture. And yet I found the book by Rolf Alexander, the name of the book I do not have, to be of some value in that he gives specific exercises for expanding the consciousness. Alexander brings into use the lever of hypnosis. I have never encountered this means in any other system which purported to lead man to the absolute. Naturally, I have not tried his system, and so my comment on its success must be limited. I have explored several systems which told of levers or techniques for shattering the illusion. His is one of them. Having worked with hypnosis, I realize that man is hypnotized nearly all the time, and there is no better way to demonstrate man's sleepwalking condition than with hypnosis. It may be fair to presume also that by using the technique of reversal of negative influence, it is possible to awaken man by using hypnosis to direct the subject toward being a reverse vector. The point to consider about auto-hypnosis is the qualification we must place on any state of mind that is reached by auto-hypnosis. When you are hypnotized by another person, a state of mind is imposed upon you, but you remain more in control over it because an external intelligence has control over it. In other words, a person may become very hysterical, as in the case of a young lady who had come to believe that she was being executed. If this condition had been induced by the lady herself, she may not have been able to extricate herself. The next thought, of course, is, can we trust anyone that far? Can we trust anyone to project us into a state of mind? What assurances have we of his expertise, his morality, etc., or his ability, or the outcome of such experimentation? And, of course, the only answer to these questions is that if we desire such a shortcut, we must either take our chances with auto-hypnosis or with a hypnotist with whom we would trust our very mind. There is another method, but this alternative has its risks and uncertainties as well. But it is better than doing nothing, and it can be an interim gamble while you're waiting to find a better teacher. A group of people can form a work society and use sensitivity techniques to open one another's eyes to some of our thinking techniques and our errors. It is similar to a psychological group therapy session. Thus, we may free ourselves by accident from many illusions using other people as irritants and critics. Such a system would be especially valuable if each person coupled with it a subsequent hour of meditation, or if the group managed to adopt a skillful mentor. To summarize the observations on the different methods of enlightenment, we can conclude that man, in his quest to find himself, has intuited the need for a catalyst. The catalyst takes on different forms because of the uncertainty of any human mind as to the type of catalyst it thinks it needs. The catalyst, if it is a system, bears the stamp of the originator because it worked for his type of personality or was accidentally discovered by him. That which occurs by accident is more reliable for evidence value than that which is born out of an intense desire of faith, because the human mind is the matrix from which many weird things are hatched by faith. We must be careful not to conjure up a preconceived idea of the absolute.